Hello and
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Sangoma, Stories from the Frontlines of Mediation. I'm your host, Batavi Levin-Tombini. Welcome to the show. And I am pleased to tell you that I have Glenn Dornfeld on the show today, and we're going to be talking about mediating on the brink. And so I'm going to dive right into the show and turn on Glenn's mic and say, welcome, Glenn. Hi.
Hi, Batavila. How are you?
I am doing just fine, Glenn. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on the show. We've been trying to plan this for some time, and I'm really excited to be on your show.
Well, it is my pleasure to have you here, and I think that it's the things that you have to work for that are, you know, so much more precious. So I really do appreciate that you're here today. And I also ascribe to the school of thought that says things happen when they should. So I think you should
I believe in that too. Yes.
That's awesome. Listen, I want to start a little forward, and then we'll go back. You know, this show is about stories, and I like to get a little bit of background as to how folks came into mediation. But how about if we start with you describing your practice? I know that yours is a bit of a mix in terms of mediation and then conventional law practice.
Well, that's true. Although almost all of my cases are mediations, I would say that more than 90% of my cases are mediations. When people come to me, most of my clients are looking to get divorced, although as we may talk about later, I also do prenups and postnup agreements. Mm-hmm. So most of my clients come to me when one or both of them want to get divorced. The first thing I do is I help them work out the terms of what's usually a divorce settlement, and then they need some legal work done as follow-up. They need a binding legal contract called usually a settlement agreement or separation agreement drafted. And frequently they also need to have somebody draft and file divorce papers, certainly if they want to go ahead and get divorced. And I do those, I perform those services for my clients after mediation. But it's all in the context of having mediated to a mutually acceptable and understood agreement.
Well, that's awesome to hear, because I didn't realize that you were at about 90% of your clients being mediations. That's really exciting for me to hear. Because, of course, I am an advocate of mediation, especially in the context of divorce. How have you come to be able to have that mix?
I just decided that that's what I wanted to do, and so I went out and put myself out to the world as a mediator and an attorney who works on mediated cases, and did the hard work that one has to do in getting one's name out and developing a reputation. I was certainly helped by a lot of different people along the way. Mm-hmm. And so now that's my, for lack of a better word, my brand.
Okay.
That's what I do.
Okay.
There are others out there who do more of an even mix of litigations or negotiations and mediations, but I never wanted to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a perfect segue into coming, you know, back now into what informs the practitioner that you are. And I like to start sort of at the beginning. I'm curious, are you a native New Yorker?
I was born and raised in the Bronx in my early years, and then when I was a young little guy, we moved to Yonkers, and I lived in Yonkers through grade school and almost throughout high school, and then we moved further north in Westchester. So I didn't spend my Wonder Bread years in New York City, but I'm a local guy.
Sure. and then that's interesting too, you know, the move from the Bronx into Yonkers into a place that is more suburban. What kind of experience did you have growing up as a kid?
Wow, I don't know. That's a broad question.
Sure.
My experience was good. We were solidly middle class. My mom worked, my dad worked, and I don't know how to describe. I mean, we lived in it, where I lived in Yonkers. It was kind of, Yonkers is the first town outside of the Bronx, so it was kind of an inner suburb. So when we played sports, like when we played baseball, we were mostly playing on concrete playgrounds or empty parking lots. We weren't playing on grassy fields.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds
it was
like
kind
it
of an urban
kind of,
suburb.
Sure,
I'm
yeah.
Sorry?
It still had that kind of city feel to it, you know. It wasn't solidly suburban.
Right. But it's definitely more suburban than had we been living in the Bronx.
Right, right, yeah. Well, then you have your childhood and so forth, and at some point you end up getting into the law. And I'm always curious about how folks make that kind of decision. I mean, for some it's sort of a default. You're a doctor, you're a teacher, you're a lawyer. For other people it's a passion and it's a calling. How do you describe your coming into the profession?
Well, my entry into law was motivated differently from my entry into mediation. I decided to be a lawyer to try to help those less disadvantaged. And throughout law school, my goal was always to be a public interest lawyer, which in fact I became.
Mm-hmm.
Even in law school, I did a lot of advocacy for people who needed help. For all 3 years of law school, I ran a group called the Unemployment Action Center, which focused on helping people who were denied or who were facing denial of their unemployment benefits, helping them prove that they had a valid case for unemployment benefits. And I learned when I first got to law school, literally within the first week or so, that you could do this kind of advocacy without being an attorney. It was lay advocacy.
Uh-huh. Right.
And so shortly
that
after...
You to get right in
go
there.
Ahead.
Yes. So I should explain to folks who are listening that Glenn and I are actually... broadcasting from different locations, we can't see each other. So we're working that out. But, I'm excited to hear that you had this experience going in. I know that a lot of people come into law school with lofty goals and they want to save the world and so forth. And by the second year, I remember folks being really kind of disillusioned about that, unless they were involved in a clinic or an advocacy program like the one that you were in. You say that you knew, you know, going into law school that you wanted to do public interest work. I'm curious about how you came to know that. Why would you want to do that rather than, you know, take the other opportunity, which is a sort of a silver spoon kind of thing where you're going to head off into the firm and make the big bucks?
It just felt right to give back. There are so many people who don't have the opportunities that I did and that I guess you did. I don't know your background.
Sure.
And some of those some people do have the opportunities but lose them and never get them back. And I thought it was a good thing to do. And my thought was that I could make a living for myself, not necessarily a splashy, fancy living, but I could make a living for myself while doing something that was good on the planet. That seemed like the perfect way to spend my life.
Well, is this something that was influenced by or inspired by your community, your upbringing? when a person comes to this understanding and says, you know, I have been fortunate in certain ways, and I want to give back. Yeah, often that doesn't just happen out of thin air. There are influences that allow that to happen. Is that something that you recall in your own life?
Well, my mom did volunteer work with an organization called ORT, which I think is still around. It stands for the Organization for Rehabilitation Through Training. Mm-hmm. And other people around us did other kinds of volunteer or charitable work, donating money to groups to help the handicapped or underprivileged. And then I went to college, and I was lucky to attend Princeton University.
Yay! As a fellow alum, you know.
There you go. But my experience of Princeton was that it really highlighted for me the differences between, or the gulf between the haves and the have-nots, because there were both there.
Yes.
And it was a real social education for me in how people were in different cliques, and people in one clique were not welcome in others, and how did that happen? And that just kind of sensitized me to sociological differences. I was a sociology major in school, so that helped too, I'm sure.
Right, yes. Something else we share in common. I was also a sociology major.
Wow, we have a lot more to talk about than we realized.
Yes, we do. and so, yes, of course, I understand how, you know, when you're studying that and then also seeing it in the world that you live in, it is going to influence and inspire you in a particular direction. And so then, you know, after college, then you went into law school and, as you said, made this decision to focus on public interest law. After your 3 years, then, where did you head off to?
Well, after law school, it was hard to find a job then, because it was right in the beginning of, or not in the beginning, but kind of in the middle of the Reagan years, and I had always assumed that I would just walk into a legal services position, but in fact, Reagan slashed legal services funding. The Legal Services Corporation was almost dismantled in those days. I exaggerate a little bit, but it was from having been a very robust program, it found itself fighting for its life during Reagan's years, and many of the cases that it used to be able to take before that, it couldn't take, and funding was cut. So it took a while for me to find the kind of job that I was hoping to get, but finally I found it. And my first job as a lawyer was working with Passaic County Legal Aid Society in Paterson, New Jersey.
Mm.
And I worked
so
there
you had to cross the bridge.
Yes, I reverse commuted.
Yeah.
And shortly after taking the job, I became admitted to the New Jersey bar. I was already a member of the New York State Bar, so,
right.
And I'm still a member of both bars.
So you head off into Passaic, and you're at Legal Aid, I guess is what it is.
Right.
What is it like to be a legal aid attorney?
Most places other than New York, legal aid is not a criminal law job. Here in New York City, when people say they're with legal aid, the assumption is that they do criminal defense because the Legal Aid Society here, that's what they do. But my office was a legal services office, and I was asked to do consumer bankruptcy and housing cases.
Okay.
And so that was the kind of work I did. And the first thing that I had to do when I saw a client was to determine whether they were income eligible.
Mm-hmm.
And the guideline was pretty strict. I don't remember what it is now, but the guideline was such that it was hard to imagine somebody living on the amount of money that would disqualify you from getting legal services.
Oh, my gosh.
It's kind of like poverty level. Family of four at that time, I think it was like earning $140 a week. That's
oh
the number that that's the number that strikes in my head. Of course, it's 30 years ago, so that amount, I'm sure, has changed. But
sure.
It was really pitiful. And I remember having one client who was shocked that he was overqualified income-wise. And I couldn't resist asking him who he had voted for in the last presidential election.
Oh, and, interesting.
And he said Reagan. And I said, well, there you go. That you voted yourself out of income eligibility.
What was his response?
He was not happy.
But what I
said was accurate. I mean, I didn't mean to, you know, shove his face into the reality, but it was true that he had helped to elect a president who had cut off benefits of people like him.
Yeah. Well, you know, Glenn, it's interesting that you raised that, and eye-opening for me, too, that, you know, I think a lot of people do vote with their hearts. They vote because they like the person, because of some kind of sense of affinity that they have to them, but that actual, you know, policy, you know, looking at the policies that the party that they're voting for espouses doesn't really cross their minds. I think a lot of people don't really do their research and see how those policies are going to impact them directly until they are in the position that this person was in and discovered that they had basically voted against their own interests. How interesting.
Yes. I'm a little bit more sophisticated now, and I know that people vote for all kinds of various reasons.
Sure, sure.
I'm sure that part of why I responded that way almost 30 years ago was because out of my frustration that I had a client in front of me who certainly needed my services, but I couldn't help him.
Yeah, but you couldn't help him. I can only imagine how frustrating that was. I mean, you went into this for the purpose of being able to give back and help people, and here you are tasked with also turning people away. What's that like?
It wasn't a good feeling.
Mm-hmm.
It felt awful to have to turn people away, and these were people who really had no other options.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't rich people we were turning away. They were poor but slightly above the poverty line people, and they were just going to go without legal services.
Hmm.
They were going to be, as I said, I did housing cases, and so people were going to be evicted because they couldn't afford lawyers.
Yeah.
Even though some of the landlords were less than reputable and honest in their dealings with their tenants. Not to say that all the tenants were angels either.
Right.
But certainly, if these people were represented, they would have had defenses to evictions.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just sad that you would see people walk out and you would know that in a week or two they would be homeless and they'd have to start all over again.
Well, you did have that experience. I'm hoping that, on the other hand, there were experiences where you felt really good about what you were doing. Can you relate some of those?
Yes, of course. I had a lot of good experiences. We had a number of good consumer cases where one of the my executive director and I worked on a string of cases involving online, well, it wasn't online then, involving trade schools where people would go to allegedly pick up skills in data entry and other fields, and they would wind up going to their to the school, and they would have one computer for 20 students.
Yeah. Ooh.
And the schools were ripping people off left and right.
Yeah.
It was really sad. And the hard part wasn't, it was bad enough that these people were wasting their time, but the hard part was that they paid for these schools with loans that they then owed, even though they got nothing out of it.
Right.
Like borrowing money to go to a school that teaches you nothing and that gives you no skill. And then
so now you settle with the debt. Right, you've settled with the debt and you have no way of actually finding gainful employment that allows you to pay it back.
And you've wasted 6 months of your life or something
right.
like that.
So what were you able to do? What was the agency able to do in regard to these schools?
It's a long time ago. I don't remember the details, but I know that we got good settlements for a lot of these people. We got the some of the schools we got to go out of business.
Hmm.
Other schools, we in other cases, we, if I remember, we were able to have the loans forgiven.
Hmm.
But I don't want to be... it's so long ago that it's hard to remember.
Sure. Well, whatever the case is, I'm sure that for the people who came and sought your services and the services of the organization, it was perhaps, you know, like a miracle. I understand that, you know, if a person is really poor, you know, they also often don't have a real legal background and can feel themselves to be terribly outmatched when going up against a school or, you know, someplace that has far greater resources than they do. So having a place that they can come to and somebody who's going to fight for them must have been terribly important. What did they say to you about the impact of having your services?
They were very thankful. Many of them, I mean, these were young people out of high school or who were doing this instead of completing high school, who were really trying to better themselves and take the next step. But as you say, they weren't very sophisticated. And so it was easy to take advantage of them. And just being able to kind of put the numbers together to start, if I remember, we did a class action or several class actions, just to put the numbers together to help these people was really inspiring.
Yeah. Well, but you didn't end up doing it for all of your life. What happened?
I loved the clients and I loved the cause, but I felt that the legal system was so inefficient and slanted against people with little resources that I decided to leave the law.
That's deep.
Yeah. And so I took some time off and then ultimately found mediation, which, as I look at it, is a way for people to settle their disputes without involving the legal system, except to the minimum extent they need to, such as filing paperwork that has to be pushed through the legal system.
Right. Well, what was your first experience with mediation?
My first mediation experience was mediating consumer affairs cases for the New Jersey Division of Consumer Affairs.
Uh-huh.
I received a notice in the mail saying that the New Jersey Division of Consumer Affairs was starting a mediation program, and if you volunteered half a day a week for 6 months, the training was free. And at the time, I was voluntarily early unemployed, early retired.
Right.
And so I certainly had the time to volunteer for half a day a week. And I loved it. Even though these kinds of cases were very different from what I now do.
Right.
They were consumer cases, and in most of the cases you had a member of the public who had bought a service or a product and was dissatisfied but was not going to have any long-term future contact with the company or vendor or whoever. They just wanted their money back or they wanted to be made whole. Whereas in family and divorce cases, people often have had very long relationships and often are going to have very long future relationships, just of a different kind, like people who will be co-parenting their children for the rest of their lives, even though they might no longer be married to each other.
Right. So the stakes are certainly different, but you said that you loved it, you know, when you first started. What did you love about it?
I loved being able to talk to one side and then the other and get past the positions and find out what people's interests were.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed the feeling of, for instance, letting a company know what redress the consumer was looking for, and often the company was saying, "Oh, is that all they want? Sure, we'll do that." Or the company might make a counter offer. I remember one case, again, I don't remember all the details, where somebody had bought carpeting, and the carpeting either was defective or badly installed, and these people placed a complaint with the New Jersey Division of Consumer Affairs, and all they wanted was the carpeting to be installed right. They weren't looking for what somebody would look for if they were suing. If somebody were suing in court, they would ask, you know how lawyers sometimes get, they might ask for $200,000 in damages and all kinds of redress. All these people were looking for was to have the carpeting installed correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And the carpeting company said, "Oh, yeah, sure, we're sorry we didn't do it right the first time. Sure, when can we come down?" And I called that. This was shuttle mediation, which
okay.
is also not the way I mediate these days.
Right.
And it was all done by phone. So I would call the claimant, the consumer, find out what the problem was and what they were looking for, and then I would call the company, the merchant, and I would go back and forth that way on the phone, and then we would draft some simple paperwork. They would sign it, and they'd be done.
You know, what's really interesting about the story that you're telling is about what happens with the vendors or with the companies. And I've experienced this myself, too, you know, mediating in small claims court. And I guess that, you know, from having more experience with courts than the consumer does, you know, I guess when you're a vendor, you're more likely to end up in court. But they often come in with this expectation that has been developed through the litigation process, you know, through the adversarial process, and we're often so pleasantly surprised that finding a resolution can be so simple when they go through the mediation process.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is something that I sort of, you know, picked up on as you were saying this. And then, of course, what it feels like for the consumer to have had to go to the point of filing a complaint and, you know, doing all the paperwork and getting the dates set up and so forth, only to find that the company would have just, you know, hey, sure, they're like, we'll do it.
Yeah. And that's what I love about mediation. It cuts through all of the red tape and all of the bluffing and positioning and the denials, the lame denials and the over-exaggerated claims of damages. And it solves the problem rather than exacerbating the problem.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, where are you more likely to see that? But in a situation where people are not going to necessarily have a long-term relationship, where, you know, the stakes are not that high. But in your current practice, and we can talk about how you came to be doing divorce mediation in particular, you are talking about situations where the stakes can be tremendously high.
That's right. Financial, emotional, familial. It gets at people's very essences and their whole lives in a very different way from other kinds of mediation that I've done.
Mm. Well,
like sometimes,
go ahead, I'm sorry.
I've been working with this couple recently where after mediation sessions, one of the parties in this couple that I've been working with doesn't want the divorce, although this party is willing to go along with the divorce because the other party wants it so clearly. And after the sessions, sometimes I take a few minutes to wrap up and do my final note-taking and put my stuff away, my laptop, etc. And oftentimes I'll see this party standing outside where we mediate, just looking off into space as if they're thinking, oh my God, my life is over. I can't believe this is happening to me. Just looking off, lost. Very, very sad.
Yeah, tremendously sad.
And this couple, they don't have children. Not to make light of the problems of people who don't have children but who are divorcing, but imagine what it would mean if you're not going to get to see your kids but on weekends.
Yeah.
Kids who you've been there to help raise, but because of circumstances and because of hostility between the parties, it's going to be living with one parent on weekdays and seeing the other parent every other weekend and an occasional dinner during the week. And your home is now empty, where you used to have your kids right in the next room.
All the time.
Yep.
Yeah. So it is about, you know, mediating with people who are on the brink into the case of divorce, of often of situations that are very painful for them. Yet you chose to focus on this particular area of mediation. How did that happen?
Well, while I was volunteering in New Jersey, as I described, I met someone who knew someone who runs a mediation organization out in Queens. And I met him. His name's Mark Kleiman. He's very well known to local people in the mediation field. And Mark asked me to come out and meet him, and I did. And shortly thereafter, he hired me. I volunteered there for a couple of months, and then he hired me to work at his organization, and he kind of cobbled together out of different grants a three-part job for me. And one of the parts, and that's the way nonprofits often do things. They have $5,000 left in this grant and $8,000 in that grant, and they can move a few things around and make a little bit of more room in this other grant. And one of the parts of my job was to be the coordinator of the divorce mediation project that he had.
Mm.
And I had the option, a very clear option, of not doing divorce mediation and not having that be part of my job, or taking a much more full-time job, having divorce mediation as part of it. And at the beginning, I was intimidated because of the very things that I'm talking about, of how personal it is, how earth-shattering it is to the participants. But he had me trained as a divorce mediator, which obviously requires special training. And now I help train divorce mediators frequently. And then I started out under his tutelage and supervision mediating family and divorce cases. And at some point in the after not too long, he said, okay, I think you can do these cases on your own. And so then I would do the cases and get feedback from him and supervision, but not be co-mediating with him. And after I was there for about 2 years, I decided to go out on my own as a divorce mediator and attorney, doing the legal work pertinent to divorce mediations. That was in 1995, so I've been on my own now for 17 years.
And I'm sure it has flown.
I didn't hear?
I said, I'm sure it has flown.
Oh, yes, it has. Very thankfully. At the beginning, I was a little bit naive, and I just assumed for no rational reason that cases would just come to me. And my first year in solo practice, I had a six-figure income, but only if you counted both sides of the decimal point.
Oh, right. Oh, goodness. So it requires quite a bit of savviness, and especially when you're in this field, you know, with mediation, it is a relatively young field. It is a growing field. But you have managed to do that. Was there a time where you had to take on adversarial cases in order to make ends meet and then slowly transition out? Or is it a situation where you just gritted your teeth and hung in there?
I gritted my teeth and hung in there. I felt confident that I could make it work. Nowadays, I'm sure it's easier than it was back then, because nowadays there's websites and there's blogging and all kinds of social media that allow you to put your name out and yourself out in all kinds of different ways. In 1995, when I first went out on my own, people were just starting to get email. I had a computer, but I wasn't on email yet, and then I obviously shortly thereafter, I don't remember what year, started doing email, but people didn't have websites back in the mid-90s. Maybe giant companies did. I don't even remember, but
I remember.
Yeah.
I remember because, you know, I took a year off between 95 and 96, and I lived in South Africa for a year doing research, and when I left, we were telnetting, and that was the big thing on campus, was to do telnetting, and so I went away for a year and came back, and there was all this stuff. We had email because, of course, we were on a college campus, and often the technology gets tested out that way, but it was a huge shift, but the shift was just happening then, and as you said, you know, folks didn't have websites, so the opportunities for you to do marketing certainly were nothing like they are now. So, I can imagine it was a slog.
Yes, but on the other hand, that also created an opportunity because since it was harder, if you were willing to put in the work, many other people wouldn't be. Now you don't have to put in that much work. If you want to put up a website, you pay somebody a few $1,000s or whatever it is, and they put up a website. And you don't need to put in that much work. And if you want to blog, you write a post or two a week, and it's a lot easier. So it kind of, back in that time, to a certain extent, you could get by and make a practice through your efforts.
Yeah.
And that was
now
a way of...
Now the competition is going to, it's kind of a little different, you know?
Yes.
I said kind of a little different. I meant it's quite different.
I knew what you meant.
Right. So you've been in it for the last 17 years, and, you know, that's a significant amount of experience for you to have an understanding of patterns, you know, the kinds of matters that are consistent in divorces, you know, when people are coming in for mediation. What are the kinds of patterns that you see when you're mediating with people who are on the brink of, you know, this earth-shattering change, as you put it?
I see more and more people coming in with more and more knowledge and information, which changes my job. Since I do the legal follow-up, it doesn't affect my business that much. It just puts them further on the path. If they come in having, let's say, looked up the Child Support Standards Act in New York and found out what it means, and then they've worked out an appropriate child support provision, not in legal terms, but in financial terms, that might save them 2 or 3 hours of mediation to first understand the law and then to negotiate or to agree to follow it or to agree on how to vary from the law. So then that just moves them further ahead toward the point where they can have their agreement drafted, including those provisions. So I'm happy to take on clients who are self-informed. The problem is that some of the time, maybe even a lot of the time, a little bit of knowledge can be a dangerous thing.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, because they might not understand all of the ramifications, and so sometimes it takes some re-education instead of education just to explain the context of the law and what courts are and aren't looking for, because ultimately, at least so far, the paperwork still has to go through the court system, and that, I presume, will be true for decades to come. So not only do they have to come to an agreement that they both understand and agree to, but if their goal is to get divorced, it has to be acceptable to a court. And
they also have to, they have to understand that the court does not all necessarily care about the things that they care about.
That's right.
Yeah.
These days also, I'm finding in this down economy that we've been in for 3 or 4 years now, people are really looking to cut to the chase and to avoid a lot of the posturing and to get to solutions much more efficiently, both in terms of their time and especially in terms of their process costs. And that's fine with me, too. I'm very happy to help people cut through, to let them do whatever they can do on their own, and to take what they bring back to me and to work with it.
Right. And of course, it highlights one of the major advantages of mediation is that you really can do that. You can steer the boat to a great extent.
Very much so. I always tell my clients that it's their process. I'm just there to help. And very often, even in the first mediation session, I'm already giving them tasks that I'm hoping that they will be able to do on their own so that we don't have to sit there and do them in a mediation session.
Mm-hmm.
I have had couples argue in session about which one of them will get the original CDs and which one of them will get the burned copies of the CDs. I hate to have to spend that time with them, but sometimes people need that.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, if they have children, they can work out, at the very least, they can work out a holiday schedule. Where are the children, which parent are the children going to be this Thanksgiving, next Thanksgiving, this 4th of July, next 4th of July. Some couples can't do that, and then I'm, of course, there to help them with that. But I always try to identify those tasks that seem that they won't be beyond my client's abilities to work through on their own. And that's a way of keeping their costs down, both in terms of paying for mediation and also in terms of taking time away from either work or their personal lives to be at mediation sessions.
Right, yeah. Well, you're talking about people taking on tasks of making really momentous decisions and difficult decisions while they're also, you know, tremendously emotionally impacted for the most part. You know, I'm still impacted by this description you have of looking out the window and seeing this client, you know, standing there and looking off into space. Are you surprised sometimes by the agreements that people are able to reach?
Often I'm surprised. I don't count all of my cases and which ones succeed and which ones don't. It would be kind of hard to do that, even if I tried, because sometimes people go away for a long time and then they come back.
Okay.
I had a couple 2 years ago call me. I hadn't seen them since 1997.
What?
They went away for over 10 years. And then they said, okay, we're ready to finish now. So you never know when... You never know when a case that has, I guess, become suspended, for lack of a better word,
sure,
comes back in to finish.
Certainly.
But,
wow.
But I've seen a lot of people go away relieved, having expected mediation to be really difficult, and having expected each of them the other to be very unreasonable and hard to get along with in mediating the terms of their settlement.
Mm-hmm.
And very often these people, when they sign an agreement, I can see kind of a smile on their face, often a wistful smile, but a smile on their face saying, you know, I'm sorry that we had to end our marriage, but I'm glad that we did it this way, and I'm glad that we saved the time and money and didn't make each other as miserable as we could have.
So even in the context of something as difficult as ending a marriage, they're still able to take some satisfaction in saying, hey, you know, we did good.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And especially when they have children, it's so important, because these people's lives are going to be tied together
yes,
regularly. I don't want to misuse the word intimately, but intimately for many years. They're going to be at a sick child's bedside together. They're going to be at deaths in the family together. They're going to be at joyous celebrations together too, graduations, bar mitzvahs, confirmations, children's weddings, all kinds of stuff, and they need to be able ultimately to work together if that's possible. And that's one of the things I like most about mediation of family matters, is that it minimizes the damage that has to be done between the two of them so that they can plant the seeds for future cooperation and an amicable, very different relationship.
Even
if there's a lot of animosity and remorse about the ending of their interpersonal relationship.
Right. Well, I'm curious about this then, because while divorce mediation is the bulk of your practice, as you mentioned in the beginning, you also do prenuptial mediation and postnups, but I'm curious about the prenups especially. Thinking in terms of a divorce mediation, if you have an agreement already, it impacts the process. But what is the process of doing the prenups like?
It's in some ways it's very similar, and in some ways it's different. When people are about to get married, sometimes, just to say what might be obvious, sometimes one or the other of them wants there to be a prenup between them, which of course is a way to specify what their respective future rights will be in marital assets, in spousal support, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Often, when one person asks for a prenup, the other person is offended.
Sure.
This is a couple who is trying to come together. Presumably they love each other. They're certainly getting married, so you would hope that they love each other. And yet one of them, and it's almost always one person asking for the prenup and the other person being shocked and surprised to be asked for a prenup. So one of them is expressing either a lack of trust or a lack of faith in the fact that their marriage will be a good one. And that's a really hard and personally hard to hear auspice for a new marriage. You want to marry me, you say you love me, but you want at the same time to have an arm's length negotiation. And most of the time, most people do it the traditional way, where each person has their own lawyer. Mm-hmm. And the lawyer's job, each lawyer's job, is to represent solely the interests of his or her client. And often that means an adversarial negotiation. In fact, the legal system kind of requires that. You are supposed to represent your client as zealously as possible within the confines of the law.
Right.
And in fact, if you don't represent your client zealously, then your client, at least in theory, has an action against you for breach of fiduciary duty, breach of ethical duty. So your lawyer, if you are negotiating the terms of a prenup, your lawyer is not supposed to be conciliatory. Your lawyer is supposed to be adversarial and try to get you the best deal, or try to get the other side to give up whatever is possible. And naturally, in many instances, that drives people further apart right when they're on the brink of getting married.
The irony is that it is astounding, it's significant. And then, yes, as you're describing this, I'm thinking to myself, perhaps that is what keeps people from, entering the process or creates that reticence. And it's more than reticence, but it's the process itself. Because, I'm thinking from a legal perspective, lawyers, generally speaking, advise people to get prenuptial agreements. We understand the legal utility of having a prenuptial agreement. But it's not just that we're going to have a prenuptial agreement, but there's a process to it, and that process itself can be tremendously difficult to go through and kind of is a damper on the romance, isn't it?
Yes, and inevitably these negotiations happen within almost always within 2 months of the wedding date, and very often within weeks of the wedding date.
People are stuck.
Yeah, I just did a negotiation, and this is one of the rare cases that I took that wasn't a mediation, where the husband was trying to get the wife to sign a prenuptial agreement in which she was waiving all interest in any marital assets that accumulated, all interest. If they were married no matter how long, 10, 20, 30 years, and if they had children together and then got divorced, she was waiving all rights to spousal support. And, in fact, under the terms of the prenup, she was waiving her right to inherit his estate, even if they were happily married at the time when he died. So even if it wasn't a divorce... Unbelievable. Even if they were happily married, and they were married for 40, 50 years, and then he died of natural causes, she was at his mercy. She could be completely written out of his will. Certainly if he chose to leave a will, leaving stuff to her, then she would presumably inherit it, but if he chose to write her out, and he had very close family, and he had said during the negotiation that he was intending to leave his estate to his family, so she could wind up literally with nothing. And he makes about three times what she makes.
Uh-huh.
So it was very clear that he was going to be the one who had a much greater opportunity to develop assets during their relationship. And he was very, very firm on this. And he said, he basically told her that either you sign this prenup as it is, or the wedding is off. And we were negotiating this at the point where all of the deposits for the flowers, the band, the hall were going to be lost because the time was so close to the wedding. We were, during the negotiation, we got to the point where we were within a week of the wedding. And all of the deposits became non-refundable at that point. It was just they were both in tears at various points during this process.
How are they both in? I'm trying to understand. And we may get these warnings about the period of time. The show has been scheduled for an hour, but we're going to continue, and it'll go into recording mode. But there may be these warnings that come out, so please just ignore that. We're going to keep on going. But I'm curious about how is it that he is in tears and yet he's the one who's making this demand.
Well, he was saying that if she didn't look at it his way, then she was just interested in his money, that she should trust him to take care of her and do the right thing, but that he wasn't going to commit to anything on paper. And he was, in fact, asking her to waive all of her rights under New York State law.
Here's the thing. My thought is that often when it comes to your prenuptial agreement, we're talking about agreements about things that go we're talking about agreements about things that go beyond what a person is legally entitled to. What your legal entitlement is the floor, and then we're negotiating about stuff that goes above that.
Right. Well, this was a negotiation that removed all her rights, and my job in as her advocate was to try to claw back whatever we could, and finally we clawed back literally pennies on the dollar. We got her very small concessions, which may well have put her in a worse place than where she started from.
Mm.
But anyway, what I wanted to do is I wanted to highlight how this is very different from what would have happened in mediation.
Right, exactly, because that was my next question, was that, you know, if you're doing this in an adversarial way, you're not able to have really in-depth conversations with people about what their interests are, right?
That's right.
Because of the nature of this process, that wasn't something you were able to really get into.
That's right. We had his attorney pressing for his advantage, and me as the wife's attorney, the bride's attorney, trying to do everything I could to slightly level the playing field.
Mm.
If they were in mediation, even when people mediate a divorce, there's an acknowledgement of the future relationship between the parties, and it discourages a scorched earth, if you will, approach in tactics and positioning.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly when people are coming together to get married, the mediator would obviously be pointing out that they need to enter the marriage on good footing and trying to help them see each other's point of view rather than driving them further apart.
Yeah.
And a mediation of a prenup would take into account both of their common interests and also the interests of those around them. I mean, you've got family flying in from New Jersey, well, not flying from New Jersey, but flying in from California, taking rooms for people living in South Jersey who have hotels that they've committed to, and all these, everybody's got their suits ready, people have rented tuxes, got people coming from all over the place, and now you have this bride who is faced with the choice between letting down her whole family and the embarrassment and shame of canceling a wedding,
mm-hmm.
and trying to explain that, or going through with this really awful deal.
Mm.
Mediation in that situation would have encouraged, obviously, mutual recognition of what they were thinking of and why, and the interests underlying their positions. And when people, a side note is, when people are mediating a prenup, it helps them do planning that many people don't do.
Sure, sure.
And it can be a very constructive process for them to think about, okay, what are we going to do about our money?
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to have joint accounts? Are we going to keep everything separate? And if they're working with a neutral who is trying to guide them to agreement, it's that person's job to help them think about the things they need to think about without saying you have to get 100%, or you have to give 100%, otherwise
Right. This
deal is off.
Right, right. Well, and then it would, so there's advantage of being able to talk about things that people often find themselves surprised about later. You know, what are the attitudes toward money? What is their attitudes toward budgeting and so forth? And then how are we going to manage our estate? But then there's also being able to get into the fears and the norms and the expectations that inspire them to want one thing or another with a prenup, you know, you mentioned that in this case that you just described, that the groom himself at points was in tears in it. You were able to learn that, you know, he wanted to be sure that she could just trust him. And so I can sort of empathize with that. I'm still taken aback by just how adamant he was about that. But when at least that much of an explanation comes out, he doesn't sound as terrible as he did when it was just, you know, I give you nothing. Especially when you're talking about the marital estate, you know, the things to which a person is just ordinarily entitled to by virtue of being married. I mean, that's what marriage is about.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. It was insight provoking to hear him talk about what his concerns were.
Yeah.
And yet, from where I was sitting, to see him acting so faithlessly and trustlessly in her,
mm-hmm.
and to be asking her to trust him,
mm-hmm.
it was hard to, again, from my seat as an advocate
mm-hmm.
for her, it was...
Right.
Hard to credit his concerns fully.
Exactly.
Had I been sitting in the mediator's chair, I'm sure my reaction would have been different.
Sure, because now you can start to ask the questions and do the reality testing and all of the other things that we do as mediators in a situation like that. Well, you know, I want to glean something from your experience, and I'm talking broadly now, this particular case seems to have had a particular impact, but over time, I want people who are listening who perhaps are contemplating marriage, or even if they're contemplating divorce, but contemplating marriage, what advice might you give about thinking about doing a prenup and approaching somebody and saying, hey, you know, we're getting married, how about a prenup? Are there lessons that you've learned from your clients that you might be able to impart?
Yeah. A lot of people hear about prenups and see the names in the papers of people, celebrities who have prenups. And there are attorneys out there who would say that everybody should have a prenup.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not in that camp.
Mm-hmm.
I think that people who need prenups are the situations where prenups are called for are where there is, first of all, if people are trying to protect the rights of other children. In other words, if a man is getting married and he already has children with from a prior relationship or marriage, and he wants to be sure that he'll be able to preserve those children's rights to his estate, that's a very common and understandable reason to have a prenup. Another good situation for a prenup, understandable situation for a prenup, is where there's a family business or even a self-held business that one of the parties owns, and they don't want the business to be entangled with the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll explain what that means. That's a good situation for a prenup, an understandable situation. If people get married and one of them owns or has a major share in a business and then they divorce, the running of the business and the ownership of the business can be clouded by the fact that the soon-to-be ex or the eventual ex-spouse has the right to a share of the business. It really can complicate matters, especially if there are voting rights involved.
Right, yeah.
So those kinds of situations, it's completely understandable for people to have prenups. I suppose also if people have tremendous amounts of money, you know, the ultra-rich, then it makes sense to some extent. But people who have to work for a living and they don't have prior children and neither of them owns a business, I think it's kind of, prenups in those situations, at least sometimes, are kind of like the kinds of tests that doctors have us do that we read about aren't really necessary, and that they wind up just padding doctors, some doctors, I don't want to paint with a too broad a brush, some doctors wind up just having people take these tests to increase their billing. And I think that there are some lawyers out there who might persuade people who don't really need prenups to have them. Anything that anybody owns entering a marriage is that person's separate property, plain and simple, under New York state law, unless the person who owns it puts the other person's name on the property. I'm simplifying. And I want to include a disclaimer here that I'm not giving legal advice.
Exactly.
That this is just a general principle, and if anybody wants specific legal advice about their situation, I encourage them to contact an attorney or mediator, and if you contact me, I would be happy to do what I can for you. But in general, people in New York State who marry, if one party owns an apartment before they marry or a house, that property is separate property if the people divorce. So a lot of the concerns that people have that, my spouse is going to immediately become entitled to everything I've amassed and accumulated during my life, that's largely not true.
Correct. I like pointing out to people, and I understand that this is really simplifying things, but technically, because we have the domestic relations law, everybody has a prenup.
That's right. Well said.
Right.
Right. And so really what we're talking about when we're talking about prenups in this context is changing the law, changing the deal that you automatically have.
Right.
And one way to look at it is you're asking somebody to waive the rights that the legislators and that the common law for hundreds of years has decided is what is fair and appropriate.
Right. Exactly. And it does come as a huge surprise to a lot of people, and I think that it's when they go to get divorced that they get the greatest surprise if it isn't something that has been on their radar, you know, to understand that you don't just decide what you want to do and walk away, but there are rules.
That's right.
About how you're able to do that. Yeah.
Good. Yes.
Well, I want to make sure, you know, there may be a little bit more conversation, but I do want to make sure that folks are able to contact you if they want to. How can folks reach out to you?
My email is my last name, Dornfeld, Dornfeld, followed by the letters ESQ for lawyer, at earthlink.net, Dornfeld, ESQ, at earthlink.net. There is no letter I in Dornfeld. Some people automatically put it in.
Sure.
And I understand that.
Right.
And my phone number is 212-740-4004.
Yes.
I can be contacted either of those ways. And I'm
right.
always happy to spend time talking to people to see if I'm a good fit for them, and I'm always happy to answer their questions as is appropriate.
Right.
And
exactly.
I can't give legal advice to somebody who's not my client, but I can answer general questions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So for folks who are listening who have more specific questions, and I certainly can imagine that, you know, based on some of the things that you've raised, Glenn, that they might have all kinds of questions buzzing, you know, go ahead and give Glenn a call and sort of explore the possibilities of getting the advice that you need. You know, Glenn, we've talked about the two major parts of the major part of your practice, which being divorce mediation, and then this other part, which is post-nup mediation as well. But the overarching thing, you know, the theme that I'd want people to come away from is that they do have this method. I don't want to just call it an option, but they have this method of being able to address these very important parts of decision-making in their lives that allows them to have a kinder, gentler process, if you would, that actually looks at their needs and their interests in ways that they can make these decisions and come away feeling good about themselves and good about the outcome.
Indeed. It's very important. And it's very, I hope that it's very empowering for people to have the option of entering a process that allows them to call the shots and to come to agreements that work for them and their situations. No lawyer, no court, no judge will ever know what a person's life is like anywhere close to how that person knows their own life. Very few lawyers meet the children. Very few judges, courts meet the children. And very few, nobody goes out to the home to see what the room is like, what the house is like. Nobody goes to your job and finds out what that reality is. So the person who can make decisions best for a given person who's involved in a family dispute is that person, with, of course, some legal information.
Right. And which is what the mediator can provide, and certainly a guide, you know, in this process as well.
That's right.
Which is the value that mediators add. Glenn, I thank you so very much for sharing with me and with this audience a bit of insight into what you do and how you do it and the benefits of it.
Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure being on your show.
Awesome. I'm really glad, and I would love to have you come back at some point if, you know, there are some developments that you'd like to share. You know, the show is all about stories, and because we live life every day, we have new stories all the time. So I would be happy to welcome you back anytime.
Well, thank you. I look forward to doing it again. I do.
All right. Awesome.
And I look forward to talking to you about other things that have come, other mutualities that we've explored during this conversation.
Yeah, sociology. That's really awesome. I'd forgotten about that, that we share that in common.
Yes.
As well, the sociologists are awesome. Unbiased opinion, of course.
Completely.
Right.
But it's true. Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure, and it's been nice to have the chance to talk to you uninterrupted for an hour and 20 minutes, even though it's been a radio interview.
Yes. Well, I'm glad that folks have been able to share in this conversation, and I thank you all for listening. I encourage you to come back again for the next broadcast when we're going to have, I believe I'm going to have Amy Marsico come on and talk about approaching conflict resolutions through telling people stories and using the arts. So I'm looking forward to that. Have a wonderful week, everyone, and we'll talk to you again next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.